Welcome back to another great episode. We're here at the 55th annual ASAM conference in Dallas, Texas. I am fortunate enough to sit down with Dr. Chad Elkin, who has a lot of really cool topics to cover today. I'm excited to talk to you, Chad. Thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's good to be here. This is a great conference. I really enjoy this conference every year. It's a way to connect with everyone, to see old friends and whatnot. Yeah. And so, yeah, but I love the fact that you're doing a podcast here with all these people around too.
Well, tell me about, let's start with conference. Is this your first conference, or how many have you been to?
Oh, I've been coming to conferences for years. So I think probably 2019 was probably my first conference. So multiple years since then, Washington, D.C., Colorado here, et cetera. I like the venue. A lot of Gaylords, a lot of big venues. A lot of fun, though. But, you know, the primary thing that I love about coming to this conference is, you know, it's like a second home for me, being able to see friends, to reconnect with addiction specialist friends in person from across the country.
Yeah.
You know, as we're usually communicating via Zoom.
Sure, right.
So this is a special time of the year for me, you know. But, you know, concerning, like, specific lectures, you know, I really always really enjoy the, you know, my favorite lectures, usually the highest impact research articles from the previous year. You know, obviously everyone stays busy working and we can't follow every piece of research all year.
Right, right.
So I think this is a great time to fill in the details from addiction research, you know, over the last year.
Right. Well, I want to ask a little bit about your journey. I know you're board certified in addiction and internal medicine, but tell me about why addiction medicine? What led you to this, and what was sort of the catalyst that got you interested in this field?
Yeah, definitely. So I started off as internal medicine, and I was working as a hospitalist and working week on, week off. Mm-hmm. You know, there's only so many vacations you can go on on your off weeks. So I started working some other jobs. I started working in a med psych hospital. Really enjoyed that. Worked my way up, became chief medical officer of the med psych hospital. And my experience treating addiction there led me to get board certified in addiction medicine and, you know, ultimately to start the company I currently have with National Addiction Specialist, which treats opioid use disorder in multiple states, Tennessee, Virginia, and Texas primarily right now.
Wow, man. Well, let me ask you about that, too. You're president-elect for the Tennessee chapter of ASAM. Tell me, I want to talk to you about Tennessee and you know, that experience coming in and prepping to be, you know, take over as president here. Tell me a little bit about some of the legislature in Tennessee that you're interested in, maybe changing or affecting, and talk to me about Tennessee in general in terms of addiction and treatment.
Yeah, no, Tennessee is an interesting state. I mean, West Virginia is the number one overdose capital per capita.
Is it really?
And West Virginia is number one, and then Tennessee is number two.
Oh, wow.
And I think that has to do with the Appalachian Mountains, rural communities with the Appalachian Mountains. That's what I personally have seen. But so there's obviously a large need for treatment in relation to substance use disorder in the state of Tennessee. You know, concerning legislation and advocacy, Tennessee is definitely one of the most restrictive states in the nation in relation to buprenorphine laws, methadone laws, et cetera. You know, as legislative chairman currently for TennSAM and as president-elect, we've done a lot of advocacy to try to make some positive changes that are evidence-based.
Right.
So we've worked with the Tennessee Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, along with policymakers. We've partnered with other medical organizations, such as the TMA, done the Doctor's Day on the Hill, et cetera. But I really, you know, one day it doesn't always cut it. You've really, if you want to affect policymakers, I really feel like you need to be there, you know, on a daily basis. And I almost think that lobbying power can really overcome any individual's power as far as influencing politicians. But some of the things we've been working on currently concern eliminating mid-level provider prescribing limits. There's a 100-patient limit for buprenorphine where nurse practitioners and PAs are only allowed to prescribe to 100 patients Suboxone. And so we're trying to get rid of that. That's one of the most recent things. But we've advocated to the TDMHSAS, the Tennessee Department of Health, and we've made a lot of positive changes in relation to the individual regulations that affect both Suboxone and also OBOTs within the state. So I do think that we're making some headway, and I do think some positive changes coming down the line. But at the same time, we're still one of the strictest nations as far as opioid use is concerned. And unfortunately, I do feel like that does act as a barrier to medications for OUD, unfortunately. Yeah. You know, and that potentially can contribute to the high overdose rate that we do have in the state.
I want to ask you, too, you mentioned when we talked before the podcast a lot about dopamine. and how that kind of is a driver in relation to addiction. I think you said that you get to a point where it's not that you're looking to feel good, you're looking to just feel normal. So talk to me a little bit about dopamine and how this relates to addiction and how it kind of factors in.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, obviously most medical professionals know a lot about dopamine. If you're listening and you're not a medical professional, maybe you don't. Maybe you just heard a few things. So, you know, just as far as the basics, dopamine is obviously a neurotransmitter in the brain between the neurons. I kind of think it is that of it as the happy neurotransmitter, happy hormone. You know, it transmits electrical signals between the pre and postsynaptic neurons, and it's associated with motivation and reward. So, the higher your dopamine goes, the more pleasure you have. The lower it goes, the more pain you have. Right. So if you won the lottery today, your dopamine would probably go through the roof.
Right.
You know, and obviously in relation to substances, all substances that people use, that gives them a release of dopamine, obviously in different amounts. So for instance, chocolate increases dopamine 50% above the baseline.
Oh, wow.
Sex increases dopamine 100% above the baseline.
Cool.
Nicotine increases dopamine 150% above baseline. And surprisingly, meth increases dopamine 1,000%.
Wow!
Above the baseline, which is insane. So you can see why certain substances are so addictive,
right?
Because the amount of dopamine release that it causes. So you obviously have a baseline level of dopamine. Your brain wants to keep that level the same. It wants to keep that homeostasis in your brain. And so it kind of tips, it's like a ship that kind of tips left and tips right. So if you raise your dopamine for whatever reason, chocolate or substances, etc., your brain will gradually decrease that dopamine back to the homeostatic level.
Right.
And then same thing, if you decrease it, it'll increase it back up. So if dopamine goes up for whatever reason, from chocolate, from sex, from substances, your brain then down-regulates your dopamine receptors along with transmission and tips it back the other way towards the side of pain till it's back to normal. Sometimes people may feel that as withdrawal symptoms, you know?
Right, right.
But it's not a good feeling, and the quickest way to get the feel normal again is to do what? It's to use substances again.
Right.
So that leads a lot of people, when they're feeling bad, to go back to the substances, and ultimately it's kind of a downward spiral.
Yeah.
Looking at our society in general right now, I feel like our society is bombarded with constant little things, whether it's from TV, whether it's from iPhones.
How true is that? Yeah.
You know, that constantly are, you know, giving small spikes in our dopamine kind of all the time. And if you continue to do that, that leads to a dopamine-depressed state, whether it's from substances, whether it's from iPhones, whether it's from whatever. And that can lead to depression, can lead to anxiety, and there's some thinking, some theories that, you know, our society currently has more depression and more anxiety due to a dopamine-depressed state because of the bombardment of all these messages we kind of constantly get in our lives.
Wow.
So I think the key takeaway concerning dopamine is, you know, do things that lead to a higher baseline levels of dopamine. Some things you can do in relation to that are like exercise, you know, and avoid things that cause like just temporary spikes in dopamine, such
as
small pleasurable things, et cetera. So I think that's the key takeaway there.
That is really interesting. You're immensely knowledgeable on these topics, and you were telling me yesterday, which was blowing my mind, you were talking about the history of addiction and how it relates to the British East India Trading Company. This was really fascinating. Can you share with our listeners a bit about this history?
Yeah, this is, you know, what's fascinating about this story is the fact that most people don't know about it. Even a lot of addiction doctors don't know the history here, but, you know, it's really the story of the first cartel. You know, in 1579, Sir Francis Drake sailed to the East Indies and specifically the Spice Islands, and he basically traded gold and silver for exotic spices. Mm. 20 years later, in 1600, the British East India Company was formed after prominent wealthy British merchants raised approximately 30,000 pounds, which is the equivalent of about 4 million pounds in today's money, to create this company. And they had to get it approved by the monarchy. Queen Elizabeth I approved it under a royal charter for 15 years. And this allowed the company to basically have a monopoly of trade between England and the Indian Ocean, which include East Indies, include East Asia, et cetera. So, you know, why did they want this trading company? Basically, Western Europe had a huge appetite for things from this area that they traded for, such as cotton, silk, dye, sugar, spices, tea, and eventually opium. So, you know, clothes in England prior to the trade were previously wool, and they were basically worn for function. Eventually, the trade led to a cultural change in London, you know, because women started wearing thin cotton clothes that kind of became, you know, quote unquote, all the rage on the streets of London.
Okay.
Over time, the company made an enormous fortune through its monopoly because, you know, they were the only one that could trade for England. There were no other companies from England that were allowed to trade. And the reason the Crown allowed this to happen is because they were getting a kickback, and, you know, they had a huge debt, so they really needed some funds.
Okay.
And this provided the funds for them. To give you an idea of how large and powerful this company was, at their peak, they had a private army of 270,000 men.
My God.
That's twice the size of the British military at the time.
That is wild.
Historically, this was the most powerful company that ever existed. I don't know if a company will ever exist that's this powerful.
Wow.
They had competition. Basically, every country had a trading company as well,
right,
to do trade for their country. Their primary competition was the Dutch East India Company.
Mm-hmm.
It was really risky to join any of these companies because it was a very long trip to the Indian Ocean. And that trip had a high mortality rate of close to 30%. So, you know, what was that all about? So they would have battles against other trading companies.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they had this large military. They would have battles against other trading companies, and they had a bunch of diseases, obviously,
right,
like scurvy, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that the chance of you making it there and back, you know, over time and continuing to do that was not likely.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty deadly. So you're making a lot of money, but at the same time, you're taking some big risk.
Mm-hmm.
So over time, the company used their money and military might to basically take over India. They formed company cities, which this is kind of interesting. It would be like the equivalent of like Exxon, you know, drilling some oil wells in Mexico and then taking over the city in Mexico and making their own laws and then governing the people and taxing them. So this is kind of wild how this ended up happening, but you know, they would create these little forts because obviously they were fighting against other trading companies.
Right.
So eventually, part of India, part of their system collapsed, and that kind of allowed the British East India Company to really take over India.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the branch officer of the British East India Company would basically make all the rules and laws for that area.
Wow.
So one of the pivotal moments occurred in 1757. The company was not paying taxes to India, and a local Indian ruler was really upset about this. They had agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had 3,000 company men, and it was 50,000 Indian in the military. So you're thinking, okay, this is not going to go well for the British East India Company right here. But guess who won? Company won. How did they win? They paid off Indian bankers. The Indian bankers then went to the 50,000 Indian men and gave them money. And then they didn't fight.
Mm.
So that battle really caused them to take over India, and then they basically started taxing the Indians themselves after that instead of paying taxes to India. So not only were they making money on trade, they're now taxing India.
Wow.
I mean, it's just wild. They obviously, besides that, they did have a dark side. They made a fortune in the dope trade.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they grew prime poppies in the Kew Gardens in Kensington, London, after they had imported the best producing opium poppies. Then they had shipped them to Benares in India, where they made a massive plantations of opium producing poppies. Then they used their famous tea clippers to transport the poppies in the form of raw opium, which kind of looks like opium balls packed in wooden chests.
Mm-hmm.
And then they needed a place to send these, what's close that they could send them to, China. So
Okay.
So that all happened around the 1770s. China's prized trade item that everybody wanted was tea. And China only accepted silver for their tea. The company basically used the black market to trade opium for tea, which made them even richer. This all led to the first opioid addiction epidemic in 1820. The people in charge in China, it was the Qing dynasty at the time, they saw the effects of what was happening to their society, the deterioration, how prominent their economy was. Now all the Chinese men are hanging out in opium dens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're seeing the devastation. So due to this, they outlawed the opium trade, but the company persisted trading through the black market. The Qing dynasty ultimately destroyed tens of thousands of chests of opium, which led to the Opium War of 1940, and the British Navy during this war, the British Navy basically used their might to bombard the Chinese coast, and ultimately the British won in 1942. This treaty that came out from 1942 from this war gave the British the right to sell opium and also gave them the territory of Hong Kong, which recently transferred back to China. Mm. So a lot of people don't know that, the history of Hong Kong there as well. So, you know, basically by military force, the company, British East Indies Trading Company in Britain, imposed an opium policy on China that turned the nation to a nation of addicts and you know, from China's, you know, perspective, destroyed a once very powerful, very confident nation. You know?
Right. So that is absolutely fascinating. And you mentioned, I think you said that the British East India Trading Company, you called it the first cartel.
Yeah, exactly.
But tell me, because you were telling me yesterday, we were talking a bit, and you told me these stories about nowadays, the cartel now, and how it's sort of, how it's integrated with fentanyl and getting people addicted to substances. Can you tell me a little bit about this? What do people not know about that relationship between the cartel, substance use and addiction, and what should they be aware of?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, this is also really interesting. I've talked to a lot of law enforcement, FBI, local law enforcement, police, et cetera, and I've learned a lot of interesting things in relation to this topic. You know, so you fast forward today, and let's look at, you know, the current opioid epidemic, and specifically, obviously, fentanyl is a major part of that. So, you know, looking historically at, you know, overdoses in the United States, you know, number one, 1999, rise of prescription opioid overdose deaths, OxyContin, Purdue Pharma. You know, 2010, rise of heroin overdose deaths. 2013, rise of synthetic opioid overdose deaths, fentanyl, analogs, et cetera, which has basically replaced heroin at this point. So, you know, fentanyl is definitely responsible for the increase in overdose deaths. Americans are now more likely to die from overdose than a motor vehicle collision, wow, which is insane. So, you know, where does fentanyl come from? Basically, it comes from China. So it's you know, there's been some laws that have been made by the United States where it's illegal for China to ship fentanyl to the North American continent. However, it's not illegal for them to ship the precursor to fentanyl, 4-ANPP, to North America, to the North American continent. So it's kind of a loophole. I don't know why we don't close it. You know, if I was president, I would definitely outlaw the shipping of any precursors of fentanyl to North America, or for that matter, anywhere else. Yeah. So, you know, there's definitely the theory that many people believe that China, you know, may be trying to pay back, quote unquote, Western, Anglo-Saxon, Europeans, et cetera, for the opioid crisis that they experienced in the mid-1800s. Mm. You know, there's also been some documents that exist that China has done an analysis and understands they would lose a direct war with the U.S. military might that we have. And one of the best ways to potentially hurt our economy to increase theirs would be, you know, internally through fentanyl, which also happens to kill military age males.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's an interesting thing in relation to that. Specifically looking at cartels, you know, so China imports the precursor to fentanyl to Mexico. Mexican cartels, specifically the Sinaloa cartel and Chapito cartel, or Chapo's son, they buy the fentanyl precursor from China. They refine it from 4-ANPP to fentanyl in Mexican labs, and they move it across the U.S. border to cartel hubs like Nashville, Tennessee, Columbus, Ohio, Charlotte, North Carolina, anywhere that FedEx would think about, oh, that'd be a good hub to be at.
Yeah.
They think the same thing,
right?
Connected to a bunch of spots, you know, high traffic areas as far as highways, interstates, et cetera.
Right.
And the reason that cartel loves fentanyl so much, and the reason it really has replaced heroin at this point, is it can be developed more easily in a hidden lab versus having to grow a crop. Huh. The DEA has farmers on their staff who really understand how to identify and target agricultural fields, but those are gone now. So it's also more concentrated and easier to transport versus heroin.
Right.
Previously, cartels would use middlemen such as gangs for distribution, such as, you know, Los Angeles gangs, etc. But now the cartel is basically in every major U.S. city, and they've really gotten rid of the middlemen. They just use their own, you know, it's just cartel everywhere now.
Huh.
But they don't look like, you know, what you would think they look like.
Yeah,
you know,
this was very interesting when you explained what this looks like now. But please, for our listeners, go through this, because I was blown away.
Yeah, so they dress like me and you and businessmen and golfers at a private country club. Yeah, they dress basically like in slacks, a polo, nice shoes, no flashy stuff. They drive whatever the most common car is, a Nissan or a Toyota, you know, in whatever the most common color is. You know, they obviously want to blend in. You know, they don't want to stand out. It makes sense. You know, they're smart. They pay Ivy League consultants large amounts of money to help create their distribution network, which basically rivals like FedEx or Amazon.
Wow.
You know, and yeah, so they're not dumb at all. And the way they, you know, the way it works is they'll come to a U.S. city and they'll look for somebody that has a substance use disorder, opioid use disorder, for example. And the definition of this is called a tour guide, but basically it's somebody that has a substance use disorder, and they're basically given free drugs to introduce their friends to the cartel so they can sell drugs to then get more customers. So the friends will then, they'll be given a phone number, like a local Dallas number, local Nashville number, local area code. It's not going to be like a 1-800 number.
Right.
So they're thinking they're calling a local number, but it's actually, that number goes back to Mexico, to a member of the cartel in Mexico. They answer the phone, that person then makes a call to whoever's closest to that person to sell them drugs. They drive to that area and then they sell them the drugs. And then they basically, about twice a day, they'll go to Western Union and, you know, deposit, you know, less than $10,000 twice a day back to Mexico. And this is happening right now in every major U.S. city multiple times, all day, every day. So it's kind of a wild process. In general, you know, looking at fentanyl in the cartel, the cartel also makes fake pills that are basically fentanyl, but they look like all kinds of common substances that people want to buy, such as OxyContin or Xanax. So, you know, for instance, they make a blue pill that is basically indistinguishable from OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the pills, you know, would kill someone that had, like, not created a large tolerance for opioids. Tolerance
right.
is basically when you use something over time, your body gets used to it. So, you know, if somebody gets pregnant, somebody goes to jail, and they were using a large amounts of opioids. If they use that same amount when they get out of jail, or they finish their pregnancy, etc.
Right.
Then a lot of times they die, unfortunately, mm-hmm. because they lost their tolerance.
Right.
So, unfortunately, like 42% of the pills that are crossing the border have about 2 milligrams of fentanyl.
Wow, 42%.
Yeah, and the reason is a lot of the people that, you know, our own opioids can tolerate a higher dose if they've been using opioids for a while, and obviously the higher amount, the higher they're going to get, the more dopamine they're going to have release. But if you give that to somebody that doesn't have a tolerance, like me or you, that's going to kill us. So that's one of the reasons that overdose deaths are so high. You know, and if, you know, I've got three girls, you know, they're younger right now, but as they become teenagers, I'm definitely going to tell them that, you know, whenever you're at a college party or something like that, just assume every drug is basically fentanyl.
Mm.
And even if it's a pill that one of your friends or somebody tries to give you, they may have gotten it from somebody else. You know, everybody, you know, those kids are usually willing, if they're kind of new, they're willing to take a pill they assume came from Walgreens.
Right.
They're not going to do like IV heroin the first time they use drugs, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, and so that's why so many college kids are dropping dead left and right, because they think they're doing one thing, and in reality, it's a large dose of fentanyl that they're doing, and they have no idea. It's really scary. It really is. So.
Well, Dr. Chad Elkin, this has been a fantastic talk. Maybe one of the most informative episodes we've done so far. Thank you for taking the time to sit down and share your knowledge with me. I think this is listeners are going to get something out of this for sure.
Zach, I really appreciate it. It was a fun interview today. It's great to be at this conference. You know, I'm going to be starting my own podcast, Breaking Down Addiction, soon. So if you want to catch me either through my company, National Addiction Specialist, or through Breaking Down Addiction, check out an episode in the future.
There you go. Check it out and subscribe, guys.